Hello, friends. We are actually beginning on page 106 of Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2. It's been about 3 months now since I've been able to come back and work in this way. Wishing it were not the case. We're dealing with several types of relinquishments in the discussion of the law of sacrifice. We're told that first the soul must relinquish the personality. I'm just reviewing a little bit. Secondly, the soul has to relinquish not only its tie, let's see, let me get rid of these, not only its tie and its gain through contact with the personal self, but it has most definitely to relinquish its tie with other personal selves. This may remind us somewhat of the discussion at the beginning of Rule 11, when four modes of destruction are discussed. Here the word relinquishment is used, and there the word destruction. Let's see if we can find number three. Okay, and this is number three. So let's say I'll put this in as the third relinquishment. Okay. The soul has also to learn to relinquish the fruits of gains of service and learn to serve without attachment to results, to means, to persons, or to praise. Each one of these could be carefully reviewed. It's sometimes difficult to serve without attachment to results one wants to see. Perhaps it's only too human to want to see the fruits of one's labors. But if one is convinced of the principles involved and has both faith and knowledge in this regard, one knows that the results are inevitable from deriving from proper service. We may have to adapt our means. We may serve at some persons and with some persons at certain times and then have to change those in the process of service. And of course, praise is a very secondary or tertiary gain. It's not the main thing at all. If we serve because of the exaltation of the ego, which praise brings, our motive is incorrect, and he says he will deal with this later. Okay. Now we come, we have finished then Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries, number 8, and that took us to page 105, and very shortly, we move to page 106. And this is the beginning of Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries, number 9. These laws of the soul are so very important, they're so very practical when we actually find ourselves beginning to live as a soul. These laws come into effect. They are different from the natural laws. Maybe I'm going to try to adjust this just a little bit, and it may help with the glare. So, in the fourth place, the soul has to relinquish also the sense of responsibility for that which other disciples may do. This is not so easy, and we frequently find ourselves, we think, with full justification, minding the other person's business, the other disciple's business. There is a particular, let's see if we can find this, we'll say sacrifice, age, old. Yes, maybe it'll be here. And we find this, yes, in the relinquishing of gain. So it's coming up very soon. Maybe there's no reason to discuss it, but it came to my memory, these three types of relinquishment, which DK asked us to build into our lives of discipleship service. So we'll get to that shortly. So it's the age-old responsibility here. In the fourth place, the soul has to relinquish also the sense of responsibility for that which other disciples do. And Alice Bailey at one point advised us to mind our own business. It sounds so prosaic, and especially since, in a sense, we are all of humanity, we are all beings, and yet, from a practical perspective, we, the entirety, we, the whole, have to deal with our own ring pass knot, our own extent of consciousness. We have to deal with our own vehicles and leave every other self-sufficient unit of the one being to do the same. Later, we will realize that we have been the one who has been dealing in every case, but for practical purposes in the worlds of three lower worlds, worlds of form, we have to act in a practical manner, regardless of our philosophical realizations concerning the oneness of all being. So many earnest seekers hold on to their fellow workers and do not relinquish their hold on them. It's a form of attachment, isn't it, or upon their activities upon the outer plane. So this is a form of attachment, and thereby hinders freedom of the one to whom one is attached, and one's own freedom. The word hold, it's a kind of a Cancerian attitude. It's an attitude related to the grasping of the not-self as if it were the self. So many earnest servers hold on to their fellow workers and do not relinquish their hold upon them or upon their activities upon the outer plane. So too much concern and discussion. Of one's co-workers. This is a subtle error, for it masks itself behind a sense of righteous responsibility, responsibility that is correct, so the individual thinks, and adherence to principles as they appear to the individual. The other person, obviously, is violating these principles. And the accumulated experience of the disciple, which is necessarily incomplete experience. So these are the justifiable reasons why we do not relinquish our concern with, our hold upon our co-workers and fellow servers, the sense of righteous responsibility, an adherence to principles as they appear to the individual. Of course, we force our understanding of these principles upon others, and they may not have the same understanding at all. In fact, their understanding may be in advance of our own. And the accumulated experience of the disciple and the accumulated experience of the other disciple may be even greater and deeper. So we're operating out of our own consciousness, which is necessarily a limited consciousness, and our own experience, which is necessarily incomplete experience. The relation between disciples is egoic and not personal. This is sometimes difficult because the personality is the obvious. It is the familiar self, and when we look at others, we may more readily see that which is of the person than of the soul. We have to really train ourselves to see the soul in others. The link is of the soul, not of the mind, or even less so, of the astral nature and of the physical etheric nature. I think I once mistakenly said earlier in this series of discussions that dispassion was related to the etheric body. It's not. It's related to the astral body. So I hope I said astral and wrote etheric anyway. A dispassionate, detached, decentralized, disciplined attitude is required. Each personality pursues its own course and must shoulder its own responsibilities, with work out its own dharma and fulfill its own karma, and so answer for itself to its lord and master, the soul. So this speaks to the independent, independent relation between personalities. The personality is related to the sign Leo, a sign of independence, of course. In a way, so is the higher self, and so is the monad, yes. But on the very first level, we must not hinder the work of particular souls in incarnation, working out through personalities. Each one of us is, in a sense, a soul in incarnation, working through a personality and trying to manage its own affairs. It's as if the doctrine of non-interference is very important in working out dharma and karma. There will be an answer to the supervisor, to the soul, and answer there will be. So DK is speaking to our independence, if not to an overdeveloped sense of individualism. That he is not promoting, because that is separative, but the idea to be of being free to work out one's own karma, dharma, to shoulder one's own responsibilities. This is a preeminent principle, especially in the new group work. I think in the Piscean age, many of us minded each other's business from a rather self-righteous and self-assured point of view. That can no longer really be allowed if there is to be true group work. Okay. Does this sound of the nature of separation and aloneness? It says, well, it does, as far as outer activities are concerned. We do have to learn how to stand alone in an outer sense, even while being closely linked and identified on the plane of higher mind, the plane of soul, and beyond. Only as servers cooperate from the standpoint of an inner subjective linking can a united world be carried forward. So this has implications for all of humanity. We see presently the way people who are persuaded to follow certain religions prey upon those who follow other religions. From a very self-righteous point of view, it leads to separatism, great divisions, fragmentation. It leads to war, really. When we seek to impose our own way upon others, we not knowing what the inner structure of the other being may be at all. We don't know their energy system. We don't know their experience over the many, many millions of years. We do not know their destiny, and yet from a very limited point of view, we seek to impose. It perhaps gives us a degree of assurance in the rightness of our own position to see others acquiesce to it, even to force others to acquiesce to it. But it is not productive of true unity. It's not productive of cooperation. It will not create the united world. At this time in the history of the world and its periodical salvaging from conditions which are wrecking the current civilization, it's as if, you know, this has happened in the past, and periodically there is a salvaging measure. We're coming near the end of the age of Pisces. There's still another few decades left, and even perhaps a bit more than 100 years, and we might see, in a sense, some of the best of Pisces emerging, the tendency to salvage, the tendency to salvage what is wrong with the civilization. It's not only the sort of catabolic falling apart of a civilization which we witness. We are witnessing that in Pisces, and Pisces does rule over that dissolving of a civilization, but also of the redemption of its best aspects. So we are in a period of periodical salvaging. It occurs to me here, I'm remembering what the Tibetan said, that about capitalism, I suppose a special kind of rampant, greedy capitalism, that it has emerged, capitalism has emerged and wrecked the world, he said. That's an extraordinary statement, but I think when we look at the environmental situation at the moment and even the way we are apparently affecting the weather patterns and the general balance of nature, we may see the greedy, rapacious desire at the expense of other people and of the planet is indeed wrecking the world and with it the current civilization. So we're in a period of periodic salvaging. I think there'll be much suffering involved in it before it is finally reaching a balanced state. It is necessary for the aspirant to grasp the fact that salvaging process must be carried on under the law of sacrifice. It's certainly, you know, we do not salvage through the tendency towards acquisition. And that only a relative outer unity can at this time be achieved, but, you know, we have to be realistic about what actually is possible to humanity at this time and not to overreach. This relative outer unity may relate to the etheric plane, and when a degree of stability is achieved in the etheric, hence physical, worlds, we can tackle the great emotional problems of humanity en masse, and the attack against glamour on the astral plane will have a surer footing. At least the glamours will not work out so forcefully upon the physical plane, disrupting the entire balance of physical life. So the salvaging process, this is an important idea, must be carried forward under the law of sacrifice, the law of the relinquishment of gain, especially the relinquishment of outer gain, which leads to a true spiritual acquisition, a true acquisition in consciousness. This is the interesting paradox, that when we learn to release our attachment to outer things, there accrues to us a gain in consciousness, in realized unity, in fact, in spirituality. Not as yet is the vision seen with sufficient clarity by the many servers. To make them work with perfect unanimity of purpose and objective, of technique and method, or complete understanding and oneness of approach, okay, we cannot yet achieve these desirable ends, but we are working in that direction. So not yet do we see, all of us, with sufficient clarity, which will allow us to work as one soul and with oneness of purpose and objective. And certainly we do not work with oneness of technique and method. We cannot work with complete understanding because we don't have complete vision and understanding. Eventually, we could say this, that this is the way the hierarchy works. But even then, there are differences in techniques, and each member of the hierarchy allows the other to be free of the impress of his perhaps controlling thought. That fluid, perfect cooperation lies as yet in the future. We don't know how far into the future, perhaps somewhat in the Aquarian age, among certain types of individuals, it will be achieved. The establishing of an inner contact and relationship based on a realized oneness of purpose and soul love is magnificently possible, and for this all disciples must struggle and strive. Well, let's just say, you know, the spiritual hierarchy has achieved this magnificent possibility. They certainly have soul love. They realize they are one being, aspects of one being. And they certainly receive the impress from the higher aspects of hierarchy, which receives from Shambhala itself, which receives from the Solar Logos and on. And they are united in the purpose of rendering this planet a sacred planet over a long period of time and in the sanctioned manner. There's probably some sort of time schedule for how this can best be achieved, but there are many turns and changes along the way. And so the time equation, though indicated, is in the hands of the workers. Okay, but the inner relationships and cooperation must be established. I guess that's a capitalized word, and, you know, it seems worth putting in red. The inner relationships and cooperation must be established and developed in spite of outer divergences of opinion, so secondary things are kept in a secondary place. When the inner link is held in love, and when disciples relinquish the sense of authority over each other and of responsibility for each other's activities, and at the same time stand shoulder to shoulder in the one work, then the differences, the divergences, and the points of disagreement will automatically be overcome. They will be seen as secondary. And the inner union, let inner union demonstrate and outer cleavages be gone, we are told in the mantram of unification. But this is so important when the inner link is held in love. And so we must not allow ourselves by any means to hold our fellow disciples, our co-workers, our fellow servers in anything but the realization of soul love. Regardless of these outer divergences, we let them go as secondary factors, unless, of course, they really are totally disrupting the power of the group and the unity of the group. Those circumstances perhaps do not occur so often. When they do, they have to be addressed again in the spirit of loving unity. When the inner link is held in love, and when disciples relinquish the sense of authority over each other. I suppose we have to have authority as a soul over our own personality and not authority over each other. It's much easier to have authority over the other. That is a kind of projection, and the history of humanity has been filled with it, for the projection of authority over others. I suppose at certain times it has been necessary where guidance must be asserted and where real irresponsibility is being shown, and that is the work of the first ray and its power of imposition, often detested, I suppose, by those upon whom the imposition is made, but at times it has been necessary. There is such a thing as Saturn and Mars and Capricorn and Aries, those kinds of signs which impose, and the sign Leo as well. Somewhere Descartes discusses that it is a noble thing to be to impose the will of God. But of course the personality elementals, they do resist that. But by the time we're achieving a certain type of maturity at this point in our development as servers, disciples certainly must relinquish authority over each other and let the other take responsibility for their own activities. I love this image of standing shoulder to shoulder because it implies, you know, that shoulder to shoulder, shouldering will be accomplished and heavy work will be done. That's what it means to stand shoulder to shoulder in preparation for doing the heavy lifting, the heavy work. Shoulder to shoulder in the one work, and then the differences and divergences and the points of disagreement will automatically be overcome, and we could say in deeper understanding. There are three rules which are important to disciples at this time, so let's see. All right, well, this is such practical work, really, when you think of it. He's telling us how to work in group formation and how to overcome those age-old personality tendencies which seek distinction and power and preeminence for the personality at the expense of the unity of the group. So first see to it that that you permit, it's under our control, no rift to appear in the inner relation in which you stand to each other. Outer rifts may occasionally appear. He discusses this under the theme of harmlessness, how outer unpleasantness may at times occur while one is searching for a harmless possibility. So the integrity of the inner band of servers must be preserved intact, and this is such an inner endeavor. Our thoughts and attitudes are involved. Okay, our thoughts and attitudes. First, see to it. See to it. When DK tells us, see you to it, or see to it, he means business here. First, see to it that you permit no rift, no cleavage, no separation to appear in the inner relation in which you stand to each other, because our entire work as disciples is to gradually unify creation under the separation, despite the separation which has been caused by limited consciousness. So as we expand our consciousness, we are going to unify the apparent separations caused by hitherto limited consciousness. So first see to it that you permit no rift to appear in the inner relation in which you stand to each other. So we hold each other in constant or abiding loyalty and in the love of the soul rising out of a realized inner unity and even identity. The integrity of the inner band of servers must be preserved intact, so the idea that we think outwardly towards each other in love is key here. Secondly, okay, so let's just see. First, no inner rift appearing in the inner relation, and I suppose we really have to emphasize that word inner, because this is what he's emphasizing, even though there may be some outer disagreements. Secondly, pursue your own duty and task, shoulder your own responsibility, and leave your fellow disciples to do the same, free from the impact of your thought or criticism. And obviously, our thoughts, and especially our critical thoughts, do have a deleterious impact upon our fellow disciples, and as disciples, we must be sufficiently aware of these subtle factors and control our own process as people who are not disciples or aspirants need not yet do, perhaps. The ways and means are many. The points of view vary with every personality according to our astrological and rheological configuration, I suppose, and our experience and our upbringing and our progress over many lives. The ways and means are many. The points of view vary with every personality. The principle of work is love for all men and service to the race, preserving at the same time a deep inner love for those with whom you are destined to work. This really must be developed, and perhaps is not as common as it should be. There is the principle: love for all men and service to the race, preserving at the same time a deep inner love for those with whom you are destined to work. Each soul grows, and of course we must recognize who these people are. They will be in our immediate environment, or immediate electronic environment, even our web environment these days, and we recognize them as our co-workers, and we seek above all to be harmless, not to hinder their activity by our own self-righteous criticism based upon our own ideas of how principles should be expressed. So worth repeating here, the principle of work is love for all men. That's all men, all human beings. Even those who apparently threaten our way of life and want to disrupt the values to which we adhere. I mean, we do not relinquish, we do not cease to fight for the values which must be preserved, but the love must still be there. And is that a contradiction to love your enemy? It doesn't mean that one must not oppose that for which the enemy stands in terms of one's principles. The opposition, there are obviously lower values seeking to emerge at this time and maybe at all times of human history, and those who are adhering to recognized higher values must oppose the attempt to reimpose the lower values, at the same time sustaining the love for those who seek to impose those lower values. This is a difficult dual attitude, and one which we must learn to cultivate. Love for all men and service to the race, and the especial deep inner love for those with whom we are destined to work. Each soul grows into the way of light through service rendered, through experience gained, through mistakes made, and through lessons learned. That necessarily must be personal and individual. It's a special formula of growth that is particular to every soul in incarnation working through a personality. But the work itself is one. So we must be able to see the one and the many simultaneously. It's sometimes a third ray ability, seeing the one and the many simultaneously and not considering them as separate. The work is one, the path is one, the love is one, the goal is one, and these are the points that matter. Well, this is one of those summary paragraphs so important that we get the principle that the Tibetan is trying to drive home to us, the many and the one, unity and diversity. And we must, in the words of Master Moria, we must learn how to contain such opposites, how to contain. The path is one, the love is one, the goal is one. We could use that as a mantra, could we not? The work is one, the path is one, the love is one, the goal is one. And in that oneness, there is a W-O-N as well. Then comes the winning. Thus is the great work won for all, W-O-N. And the achievement of the destiny of the path is won, is accomplished, and the love which must develop is finally winning over the separativeness which presently prevails, and finally the goal is achieved, the goal is won, W-O-N. These are the points that matter. Okay, I'm getting myself warmed up here, little friends. It's been about 3 months since I've done this, so bear with me. Thirdly, preserve ever in work the attitude of mind which must grow out of the two rules above, faithfully followed. So it's the attitude of mind which grows out of what? What does it grow out of? It grows out of pursuing our own task, shouldering our own responsibility, and not letting any rift appear. And a certain attitude of mind will grow out of preserving those two rules. Our point of view, your point of view, and consciousness are your own, and therefore are for you right. It seems here as if we acknowledge that there is a relative truth. To which we as individuals can adhere. Not necessarily as that which seems so clear to you and of such vital importance to you, of the same value or importance to your brothers. Each is busy, each has a next step, and your next step is not necessarily that of your brother. Your important principle may be realized by an abler mind than yours and by a more advanced disciple as embodying an aspect of a greater principle, an interpretation of a principle, correct and proper at a certain time, but capable of a different application at another time and by another mind. So we cannot reduce others to our state of mind, when in fact their state of mind may transcend our own. Under the law of sacrifice, these three rules might be interpreted thus. And these are the ones which I had been remembering and which are so important even after years and years of work. It takes a long time to wear away the tendencies to do exactly that which DK says here must be relinquished. So relinquish or sacrifice the age-old tendency to criticize and adjust another's work, and thus, in doing so, preserve the inner group integrity. More plans for service have gone astray and more workers have been hindered by criticism than any other major factor. Yes, criticism, how he discusses it at one point, how it produces pain and disruption in the life of others in a vile manner. This is not constructive correction. DK is offering that analysis within the state of synthesis. He says, allow me to analyze for you your present condition, your state of consciousness, and thus present certain facts which may be helpful to you. Present them with no intention to belittle you, but only to help you to grow. Constructive criticism or constructive analysis within the field of synthesis is meant to promote growth and not to tear down and to belittle. Relinquish or sacrifice, notice the two words are considered equivalent here, the age-old tendency to criticize and adjust another's work, and thus preserve the inner group integrity. Again, he does not seem to care too much about occasional outer flare-ups and occasional outer frictions, dissonances, difficulties. It's the inner group integrity which, above all, must be preserved. I'm remembering reading of two men who were in great danger. They actually hated each other and had a great score to settle with each other, but the danger that they both were in was still a greater factor and forced them into a begrudging and necessary cooperation. So overcoming lesser rifts for the sake of a greater goal, this is something we all have to learn how to do. I oftentimes think that if humanity itself were faced with great environmental danger, or say with, you know, some sort of invasion from aliens, you know, how the modern movies show it, that they would have to pull together and overcome their separations. And only once those other outer pressures were released would they be free to go back to their previous conflicts. Perhaps then the outer pressure on all humanity has to be sustained so that it does not quite have the liberty to give in to the lesser disruptive conflicts within itself and is thereby forced into cooperation. So let's really try to remember this, that workers have been hindered, plans for service have gone astray, caused more by criticism than by any other major factor. It's difficult to catch oneself when in the throes of self-righteous criticism. We feel justified. We feel that the work demands it, that good will come of it if we can put people in their place and have them do things correctly. And correctly so often means just as we would do it. But long experience in the work, and the Tibetan has such long experience, compels him to write as he does and show the disruptive nature of this self-righteous criticism. So, we will not then criticize and adjust another's work. We are to relinquish and sacrifice the sense of responsibility for the action of others, and particularly of disciples. I suppose when one is a parent, one has some sense of responsibility for the action of one's children, because truly, their level of maturity does not allow them to know better, and they can place themselves and others in danger unless we do exert a sense of responsibility. But our fellow disciples are not our children, are they? They are our co-workers, they are our brothers and sisters, we cooperate with them. So relinquish or sacrifice the sense of responsibility for the actions of others, and particularly of disciples. They must do what they must do. And a parent is particularly taught this through his children. DK discussed this, I think, in the previous program we did, which was program number 8. See that your own activity measures up to theirs, and in the joy of struggle. Obstacles are possibilities, says Master Moria, so there is a joy of struggle, not just the pain of struggle. In the joy of struggle and on the way of service, the differences will disappear and the general good will be achieved. It's really, in a way, a case of prioritization and always minding our own business and adhering to our own responsibilities and carrying them out and allowing others to do the same is a major responsibility. We become responsible for an attitude which will allow others to be responsible for themselves. So we give up criticism and we give up the sense that we must control other people's lives. Because if we attempt to do that, then the divine will does not come through. Everybody is an aspect of the divine will, is an aspect of the divine being, and only if that will can be expressed in a particular way, not well-meaningly hindered by the imposition of other methods upon the expression of that will that actual will come through. We can block the expression of divinity by imposing our own methods upon other people. So we have to leave them to the expression of their own divinity as they begin to sense that divinity. Even our well-meaning attempts can be a block to the divine will. And number 3, relinquish the pride of mind which sees its way, the ways of the mind and its interpretations to be correct and true, and others to be false and wrong. This is so common, unfortunately, among the mental types of disciples. They have that pride of mind based upon a limited point of view and limited experience, which sees its own way as correct and therefore other ways as lesser. This is the way of separation, and the mind can be the great separator, we understand. Pride of mind is one of those limitations which many disciples, all of us, have to overcome, and probably we recognize at times the existence of pride of mind in different contexts, and when we do recognize it, take good note of how it does express. This is the way of separation. Adhere to the way of integration, which is of the soul and not of the mind. Well, the mind can be used under soul impress as an integrated factor. It can be used to further integration, but by itself it is separative and not integrative. We are speaking, let me see if I have that. We are speaking of lower mind. So, no criticism. Let others do as they will. And do not hold the attitude that one's ways are correct and others are false. I suppose there come moments of judgment when dealing with actual, blatant good and evil. The hierarchy itself made a choice during the Second World War and saw the Axis powers as a representation of the powers of evil, and the ways of the Allies represented the ways of light and were more correct and true than the ways of the Axis, which were false and wrong. But we are now speaking more of relations between disciples and co-workers, and we're talking about the hindering of the work. That hindering occurs far too often and is unnecessary. We're actually talking about how to create the right atmosphere for group work, for approach to the ashram, for the fulfilling of the ashramic rules, for real integration into the ashram. It, following these rules will lead to this. So there were three rules and three interpretations. Let's put that down. And three interpretation, which are a bit more concise, perhaps, than the rules. And each one of us must test himself or herself as to the ability to carry out these three rules and their practical expressions. Well, DK realizes that these are not easy things, he says. They are hard sayings. A hard saying is something that runs right up against our normal expectations, even our normal values, the decisions we have made about what is correct and true and good. And the ageless wisdom comes along and says that we have to give up those determinations. And therefore, thereby, a hard saying arises. But they are rules by which the teachers on the inner side guide their actions and their thoughts when working with each other and with their disciples. And we do see how Master DK, as the secondary master, tends not to coerce, to force, to impose. He can be very strong in his opinions, and he can be very strong in his suggested guidance, but he never regiments or demands or forces the will of another. That is the key to the difference in how the Black Lodge works and the White Lodge. The White Lodge will never force the center of will. The Black Lodge will, in fact, attempt to compel the center of will. The inner integrity is necessarily a proven fact to them, and for people such as ourselves, we're attempting to move closer to establishing the proof of it. To the disciple, it is not necessarily proven, not yet proven. But to the inner teachers, the outer differences are abhorrent. Okay, that is a strong word. To abhor is to detest in a very strong way, to find it as a horror and repulsive, repelling, highly undesirable. The outer differences are abhorrent to the inner teachers. They leave each other free to serve the plan. They train their disciples, no matter what the degree, to serve the plan with freedom. For in freedom and in the sense of joy and in the strength of inner cooperative love is the best work done. The best work. And that deserves noting as well. For in freedom and in the sense of joy and in the strength of inner cooperative love. He always has that descriptor, inner, does he not? Lest we take too superficial a point of view and simply attempt to show a kind of superficial outer cooperation, which is not real and does not reflect a true inner attitude. For in freedom and in the sense of joy and in the strength of inner cooperative love is the best work done. I'm remembering now what he said of criticism. I was searching for it earlier. Criticism, that dire creator of misery. Could these words be stronger? That dire creator of misery. And he tells us that no good work can be done under a sense of failure. So criticism causes misery. The sense of failure compromises the work. And these factors, freedom, joy, and the strength of inner cooperative love, promote the best work. It is sincerity for which they, the masters of the wisdom, the inner teachers, work. I mean, we're being told here, really, are we not, do as the masters do. Try to approximate that. That's what we're being told. It is sincerity for which they look, the willingness to sacrifice the lesser when the greater is sensed, is that for which they search. So many of us giving up the adherence to lesser things. We can be faced at certain times with the realization that our familiar preferences are lesser preferences. We can begin to see that there are higher values, objectives, and preferences, and there comes the choice, the Libran choice. Will we relinquish the lesser for the greater? Under Scorpio, sometimes that choice is forced because the soul takes command and, under the law of repulse, expels the lesser choice. They search. The spontaneous relinquishing of long-held ideals when a greater and more inclusive presents itself is their guide. That's how they operate, and that's what they look for in us. The sacrifice of pride, I guess the willingness to humble oneself in the face of greater beings and values, the sacrifice of pride and the sacrifice of personality when the vastness of the work and the urgency of the need are realized, sway them to cooperation. Why look only at oneself and one's status when there is a vast process underway to render this planet a sacred planet and eventually to render the entire solar system cosmically a sacred solar system? So I think Master Moria says that cosmic perception wears away irritation. And cosmic perception, perception of the whole, as we're told in Rule 5, the macrocosmic whole is all there is. Let the group perceive that whole and then no longer use the thought, my soul and thine. Even the pride of one's own egoic vehicle, that has to be sacrificed too. The sacrifice of pride and the sacrifice of personality when the vastness of the work and the urgency of the need are realized sway them to cooperation. It is essential that all disciples shall learn to sacrifice the non-essential in order that the work go forward, and it's only up, you know, others can tell us what the non-essential is, but we have to arrive at that determination ourselves. We have to finally realize what it is that we've been doing that is really non-essential to the greater goal. And DK promotes this emphasis upon the essentials rather than the secondaries. Then sacrifice is involved because we're used to the non-essentials and we're comfortable with them, and they provide a certain familiarity to our life and a certain kind of superficial outer assurance. So here we are at the beginning of the new year. This is January 1st, 2014. And one could say, what which is non-essential in my life am I willing to sacrifice? Nobody can answer that for anyone else. This has something to do with our New Year's resolutions coming under this very strong first ray fixative Capricornian energy. It's an energy of resolve, of determination, of fixity, of a solid structure which is sustained in the face of that which would change it. Sacrifice of the non-essential in order that the work may go forward. Little as one may realize it, the many techniques and methods and ways are secondary to the major world need. So keeping the welfare of humanity always in our mind, keeping the need of humanity as a whole in our mind, and the need of the planet increasingly forcing itself upon our perception, these are the major factors. We must be variable, adaptive in techniques. Perhaps that's why an adept is called an adept. He can adapt himself and use many different techniques which are suitable for the fulfilling of the need under special circumstances. There are many ways and many points of view and many experiments and many efforts abortive or successful, and all of them come and go. So as good as they may be, they are secondary to the larger goal. Let's get that word larger correct. But humanity remains, and it's the welfare of humanity above all that is our preeminent goal. Sometimes we have to stand back from our particular contexts and our particular type of work and our particular methods and say, okay, what really does humanity need? And great generalities may occur to us, and probably the needs will be intimately related to the three divine aspects: more light, more love, and more spiritual will, more sacrificial will for the greater things. Okay. We are at that point. Well, let's go on. The 1 hour has passed, but let's go on. These have been somewhat two-hour programs. All of these many efforts, experiments, techniques, etc., are in evidence of the multiplicity of minds and of experiences, but the goals remain. So difference is ever of the personality. And our personality mind tends, first of all, to perceive difference in all things. It has not yet reached the capacity to see the one in the many and to reduce the apparently diverse to a unified field. But that's what we learn to do as we go along, and exercises in the reduction of difference, seeing the apparently different as the same. These are exercises to be pursued, each in his own way. When this law of sacrifice governs the mind, it will inevitably lead all disciples to relinquish the personal in favor of the universal and of the soul that knows no separation and no difference. And until we reach that point, and it's a subtle realization where despite outer distinction there is no real difference, then we are beginning to live the life of the soul, and before that we're simply talking about it. So there is this injunction, lead us from the individual to the universal. And then no pride, nor a short and myopic perspective, and for which one of us is the perspective not myopic? Certainly is when compared to that of the masters. Excuse me. Then no pride and nor a short and myopic perspective, nor love of interference so dear to many people. And the we remember here, don't we? The glamour of interference belongs to the sixth ray under which humanity has been so conditioned for so long, and still, I think, another 21,000 years remaining in a larger sixth ray cycle for us. Nor love of interference so dear to many people, nor misunderstanding of motive will hinder their cooperation with each other as disciples, nor their service to the world. So this is specifically about how disciples are to regard each other, treat each other, cooperate with each other. When we cannot necessarily apply in full measure these rules to our dealings with all people, our children, I mean those that we must guide and so forth, but we can and must apply them to our co-workers who stand with us pretty much on the level and must be treated in a particular way which will not disrupt the group integrity. It will promote the group integrity when we are able to follow these rules. They may seem very simple. As is so often the case, the simple injunctions are the most important. And the details of the ageless wisdom which delight the mind, and I must admit I've been as delighted as anybody else, are oftentimes not indicating the main points at all. The foundation has to be in place before the details have real application, and the foundation has to do with right human relations and right relations between disciples. Well, actually, I probably should call it a day here, because this is the beginning of Rule 2. So why don't I say here the end of Laws of the Soul, webinar commentaries number 9, and let's see what page this is, page 109, and 109, and this is the end of the Law of Sacrifice, and beginning of Laws of the Soul, webinar commentaries number 10, page 109, beginning of the Law of Magnetic Impulse. Probably I should have continued with this 3 months ago, and I didn't realize somehow that I was so very close to the conclusion of the Law of Sacrifice, but this is the preeminent law. It's the first law of the soul, and so often first laws, first rules are the ones whose quality must be sustained throughout the other following laws. If we can learn to live the sacrificial life, relinquishing the life of the personality for the infusing life of the soul, not killing the personality but rendering it the fit instrument, the subordinate of the soul, then we will be treading the way of integration, and we will find ourselves integrated into the divine plan and useful in the great work which the spiritual hierarchy of our planet is undertaking. Can we do that, though? That is the question. Do we care enough to do it? It's a daily obligation, and this is, interestingly, a day of obligation, this January 1st. I think in the church calendar it's called the Day of Obligation. Certainly it's a day of resolution. I kind of waited until January 1st to begin this work again because I know the power of it, though 3 months is too long to be away from it. Can we treat this need for sacrificial living as a daily obligation? This is our question, and something to which we can hold ourselves accountable, and something to which we will be held accountable before the bar of the soul at those moments of judgment which do occur in the midst of a life and also following an incarnation, when we see so clearly what we have done, what we might have done, what was intended to be done. Okay, friends, it's a little more than an hour here, but I will go on now with the Law of Magnetic Impulse, but I'll start a new program to do that. So we'll see you shortly with Laws of the Soul webinar commentary number 10, page 109, the Law of Magnetic Impulse, and we'll be back to you shortly. Bye-bye.